From Nevada to Ohio, Illinois to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, once again, President Biden is trying to transfer student loan debt to taxpayers without congressional approval. Will the courts again put a halt to the scheme? Phil Kirpin of American Commitment is here to discuss. Inflation continued its upward spiral in March as more and more Americans are feeling the pinch of the rising price of necessities. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The federal government is placing new regulations on credit cards, and of course, there will be some unintended consequences. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine reports. And high-profile conservatives from across the country spoke at the recent Pennsylvania Leadership Conference as that state prepares to become a key battleground in the presidential election. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Supreme Court of the United States has ruled the Biden administration must have congressional approval to transfer billions of dollars in student loan debt to taxpayers. But the president is moving forward with a new plan to circumvent that ruling. Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. He joins us now to discuss the latest maneuvering. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, President Biden, despite a number of court setbacks, still appears to be determined to try and give away taxpayer dollars via so-called student loan forgiveness. He's rolled out yet another plan. What is the president trying to do this time?
Well, this latest version, we haven't seen all the details yet because this is going to be a rulemaking of some kind. But the latest version, it looks like, is going to focus on people who have a large amount of interest that's accumulated over a number of years, and he's basically going to write off the interest. And it's important for all of these, and this is the third sort of major blanket across the board. The first one was overturned at the Supreme Court. The second one is already in litigation, and now he's got this third one that he's announced. There also have been a lot of kind of smaller ones that nobody's been able to challenge that have happened. And so he's already given away hundreds of billions of dollars. And what people have to understand is that since 2010, all student lending in this country has been done by the government. Student lending was nationalized in 2010. It was supposed to be a revenue source to help pay for Obamacare. It was supposed to be a way the government would make money from the student loans. They say, oh, the banks are making too much money. It would be better if the government did it and we'll make all this money. Of course, they've been losing money ever since. And so when the president comes in and says, I'm going to forgive this class of loans or that class of loans, what he means is the money that taxpayers lent to people in student loans will not have to be paid back, which they will be on the hook for having paid for people's college and then them not paying it back. And, of course, that will directly increase the federal debt. And his first round plan, he just said, I'm going to knock 20,000 off every loan balance, essentially 10,000 or 20,000 off every loan balance. And the Supreme Court said that's unconstitutional. You can't do that. There's no legal authority for the president to do that on his own. And then he came up with this idea of he'll change the terms of income-driven repayments, and you only have to pay 5% of your income above 250%, I think it is, of the federal poverty level. And if you do that for 10 years or 20 years, then the whole balance will be written off. That's now subject to two lawsuits. There's been one group of states led by Kansas that filed a lawsuit against that, and another group of states led by Missouri that I think either is about to file a lawsuit or just filed it today. And so that one is being litigated. And then he announced another brand new one, which is this one focused on people who have a lot of accumulated interest. And he's going to say, hey, you don't have to pay your interest. And so we had three rounds of these sort of these big multi-hundred billion dollar attempts. I think that Plan B and C will probably both be stopped in the courts the way Plan A was. But you never know. And that's why he's trying. And he'll see what he can get away with the courts. And maybe more importantly, even if he, you know, you'll notice the announcement, his most recent Plan C announcement, he said, if implemented, it'll not, you know, these people won't have to pay, it'll be forgiven. So he's already kind of hedging a little bit that this might not ever happen, but he still wants, I think, credit on Election Day for having tried. And he's trying to juice turnout with younger voters where he's had some weakness.
we still get down, no matter which round it is, A, B, or C here, Phil, you still get back to the same fundamental constitutional question, which is, it is a requirement of the Constitution that the U.S. House of Representatives originate spending and that spending has to be approved by Congress. So are all of these really just a workaround to congressional power?
Yeah, basically. I mean, they try to find a statutory basis for doing it. And so, you know, they'll say it would, you know, the original one, they said it was in a bill that was passed called the Heroes Act after 9/11 that would let the Secretary of Education modify loan terms for people because of a national emergency. And it was supposed to be about, like, first responders or reserves who get called up and deployed. The Secretary could, you know, say you could delay your payments or whatever it is. And they tried to say, we can just forgive loans for everyone because of COVID. And the Supreme Court, of course, said, no, that doesn't work. And I think this most recent one is under the Higher Education Act, and I'm sure they have some very clever legal theory. And the problem they're going to run into in the courts is that this idea that you can just grab old laws that were designed for something else, a different circumstance off the shelf, and refashion them into a brand new program that costs hundreds of billions of dollars, that is not something that our current Supreme Court looks favorably upon. And, of course, we got the decision in West Virginia versus EPA a couple of years ago where they said, hey, the EPA can't impose greenhouse gas caps on all the power plants using, you know, the 1970 Clean Air Act because that's not what the law was designed for. And if Congress wanted you to do that, they would say so. They would pass a law that says so because that is a major question. And I think that's the big problem that Biden's got with all of these attempts is even if you can contort some law to say, hey, actually, Congress did say we could kind of sort of do something like this, the scope and scale of what they're doing is so enormous, and the hundreds of billions of dollars involved are so much money that I think the courts will say, hey, you know, this is a major question. If Congress didn't specifically tell you to do it, it's not going to fly.
Aside from the constitutionality and the legality of all this, does this not also go to an issue of fairness, assuming anybody cares about fairness anymore here, Phil, that you have a section of the population that went out, took out a loan, got something supposedly of value for it. Those who never went to college or who did pay their college loans are not going to have to underwrite that as taxpayers. From a political point of view, that might play with the actual people who are getting loan forgiveness, but can it also work against him with other people who look at it and say, hey, why are you taking my money to pay their bills?
I hope so, and I hope the Republicans don't run from this debate, because the way you lose a debate like this is not engaging in it, right? Letting the other side make their arguments to their audience and not refuting it, not debating back. And I think that it's profoundly immoral to force people who either never went to college or who paid their own way to cover loans for others. And, you know, I do have some sympathy for people who are in destitute financial circumstance and a heavy burden of debt. And the solution to that has always been in this country the bankruptcy laws. And so I would be open to reforming the bankruptcy laws to make it easier to discharge student loans in bankruptcy if you do it the right way.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Tell us a bit about American Commitment. Phil, also, where can folks find you on the web?
We're a national free market organization. We try to focus on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues where people might make a difference. And so a lot of our members of our email list put comments into the Education Department on all these different rounds, and that at least prevents them from saying everybody wanted us to do this. So we try to put a little balance in the official record, and we also help develop one of the legal theories behind the first case that was successful. And if folks want more information or to get any of our materials, everything's on the web at AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. As always, Phil, thanks for being back with us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Loman. Have a good one.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. He's been monitoring the latest economic numbers, inflation up again coming out, and also some interesting maneuvering taking place in the U.S. House of Representatives. We're going to talk about all of that with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
It's always great to be with you, Loman. Thanks for having me back.
And you are on the road in Virginia today, so we appreciate your taking time to be with us. And even on the road, you've seen what the numbers are out, inflation up again this past month. Doesn't seem like Bidenomics is really working out too well for too many people, does it?
It doesn't. Obviously, the Federal Reserve has sort of this target benchmark of 2% inflation where they feel like that's a level that the economy can handle. And we're still at almost double that. When you look at the annualized rate, it's 3.5%, and obviously far lower than where we were with peak inflation at, I think, 9.1 or 9.2% about 18 months ago. But Bidenflation is still raging. And when you think about the cost of electricity being up 30%, when you think about the cost of different food items, whether it's eggs or milk, basic necessities for the American people, it turns into a real kitchen table conversation. And we know that the higher costs underneath Joe Biden's policies are ultimately fueled by his radical policies related to the energy industry and his attack on fossil fuels, this salacious desire to move us toward lithium batteries and electric vehicles. We know that our electric grid can't even sustain all that. Think about when it gets cold in the winter up in Minnesota. You think you can plug in electric vehicles? So there's a lot of folks right now that are like, what is going on here? Why are we purposefully damaging the economy with an attack on an efficiency that has sustained our economy for so long? And when I say that, I'm specifically talking about oil and fossil fuels and even natural gas. In just this last month, the inflation ticked up 0.4%. And that's still a level that when you think about the year-over-year levels, month-over-month, the added cost, it's basically this vanishing earning power that the American people have. So I want to make sure that we've got a healthy economy. That starts with having smart energy policies, and I think it ends with getting inflation tamed through fiscal restraint in the federal budget.
And, of course, since the beginning of the Biden administration, inflation up almost 20% in just a little over 3 years. So we're going to keep an eye on those developments. Meanwhile, back in Washington, D.C., the House of Representatives in turmoil once again on a number of issues. Something called FISA has to be reauthorized. What is FISA, Scott?
Well, it's the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And this is basically how our three-letter agencies do surveillance when it comes to foreign nationals, when it comes to people that are here illegally that they're monitoring, when it comes to people that are not United States citizens. And let's say that there's a couple of known terrorists talking in America, and they're talking with each other. The intelligence agencies certainly have the authorization to listen in on those conversations. But let's say that one of them hangs up and he happens to call Loman Henry and he says, hey, I need supplies to build a fence. And then Loman Henry hangs up the phone and he calls Scott Parkinson and says, hey, Scott, I need to order fence supplies from you. They're listening to those conversations, and that's American and American conversations. Tens of thousands of instances that have been cited in, I think, an FBI report where they did not get a warrant to listen in on those American conversations. That's a violation of our constitutional rights. And so within the House of Representatives, there was a big, big debate over whether or not we were going to require a warrant to tap and listen and surveil American citizen conversations. And if we were going to push back against really this huge overstep of authority from our intelligence agencies, there's people that go back to the Patriot Act and they're going to say, well, we want to make sure there's not another 9/11. Well, 9/11 wasn't caused from American citizens. Let's be clear on that. So we can protect our American rights. We can protect our God-given constitutional rights and make sure that they're not surveilling American conversations without a warrant, is what I would say.
Meanwhile, we have a situation in the House of Representatives, the United States House of Representatives, where just one member can move to vacate the Speaker's chair. We saw this happen with Kevin McCarthy toward the end of last year. A leadership battle ensued that lasted for weeks. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, is threatening that action again. Scott, where does all that maneuvering stand?
Well, there have been conversations between Congresswoman Greene and the Speaker. I think he's been pretty clear that he wants to remain the Speaker and avoid the drama of another three-week process to, you know, basically find a new pope, is what I'd say, tongue-in-cheek. But Marjorie is incredibly frustrated from the last fiscal deal that ultimately provided additional money toward Ukraine, even if it's a small amount. And then there's a continued conversation about providing a larger package of tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine. She's been out there saying, if you guys pass Ukraine money, that I'm going to do a motion to vacate. And so she filed the motion to vacate a couple of weeks ago. She's still been deciding whether or not to call it up and push for a vote. But we've got a one-seat majority in the House of Representatives. that ultimately is reflective of not having much of a majority at all. And so the Republicans are obviously passing legislation like that appropriations bill with more Democrats than Republicans. That's not a good sign for Mike Johnson. And I think what Marjorie's trying to wrestle with here is, how can we actually get to unity in the conference? How can we grow our majority? How can we actually show the American people that we're fighting for them and not for the Washington, D.C. political establishment? And I think that's something that Johnson's going to have to continue to wrestle with. He has offered her sort of an olive branch in terms of being one of the impeachment managers for Mayorkas, but the Senate's just going to basically thumb their nose at that one. And then so Johnson said, okay, how about I bring in sort of a kitchen cabinet, a circle of advisors? Would you be interested in being one of those, Marjorie? That's something I think she's publicly commented on. She's certainly considering that.
Well, you certainly have a lot of maneuvering going on in Washington affecting FISA and a whole wide range of other issues, which we will keep tabs on with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners want to learn more, the website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
The federal government is placing new regulations on the credit card industry, and there are going to be some unintended consequences, as we learn from Eric Mame of Reason Magazine.
And now it's time for some lessons in unintended consequences. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Bain with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. At Reason, we have a whole series of little videos on our YouTube page titled Great Moments in Unintended Consequences. I think there's like 15 or 20 of them at this point. Colleagues Meredith and Austin Bragg put them together, and they're terrific. Great little nuggets of government attempts to meddle in the economy that obviously backfire in ways that policymakers never saw coming. And I've got two stories for you this week, related stories, that I think maybe someday might find their way into that series. Stories about unintended consequences in the ways that the federal government is trying to meddle with your credit cards. And let's start with last month's decision by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to cap credit card late fees at no more than $8 per month. On the surface, of course, this sounds pretty great. Nobody likes getting hit with late fees for missing minimum payments. I mean, I certainly don't. Previously, those late fees averaged about $32 per month, but they vary from credit card to credit card, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau estimates that this change could save some Americans about $220 a year in lower fees. In his State of the Union address last month, President Joe Biden touted this change as part of his overall war on junk fees. But one of the likely consequences here is higher interest rates on credit card purchases or stricter limits on who gets access to credit in the first place. Vince Ginn, an economist and former White House Associate Budget Director, wrote about this in a post this week at the EconLib blog. He writes that while it could save some people money if they slip up and pay late, credit card companies will find a way to compensate for this lost income. In trying to shield us from high late fees, the government will set up a situation where credit is harder to come by and more expensive. And I think it's also worth dwelling for just a moment on some of the similarities here between this new rule and the Biden administration's ongoing attempts to forgive student loan debt. Now, capping the late fees on credit cards isn't as outrageous of a thing to do, but I think both actions reflect this general view from the administration that government should try to shield people from the potential economic downsides of their own voluntary financial decisions. And despite Biden's attempt to call this a junk fee, it's really not. The only people who pay credit card late fees are those who make purchases on credit and then fail to make the minimum monthly payments on their balances. It's certainly possible to have sympathy for people who miss payments because of economic hardship, and I do have sympathy for that, and I've missed payments and paid late fees before, and I don't like it. But that doesn't change the fact that those fees, they're a basic part of the contractual obligation that anyone assumes when they use a credit card. Late fees are clearly spelled out on every monthly statement, and they exist to encourage you to pay on time. For that matter, this is the same reason why the IRS will charge you a penalty if you don't finish your taxes this week. But of course, for some reason, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau doesn't seem too interested in preventing those fees from happening. Now, to the extent that capping late fees will translate into higher interest rates for all credit card users, not merely those who are delinquent with minimum payments, then the effect of this rule will be to impose marginally higher costs on individuals and families who are using credit cards responsibly, rather than those who are not doing so. And I think that's fundamentally unfair, and frankly, it's none of the government's business, and above all that, it seems ripe for some serious unintended consequences. Now, unfortunately, that's not the only way in which the federal government is trying to meddle with your credit cards. There's also a bill in Congress, the Credit Card Competition Act, and it's a bipartisan proposal from Senators Dick Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois, and J.D. Vance, a Republican from Ohio. And what they are trying to do is artificially cap the so-called swipe fees that exist that are charged by credit card companies such as Visa and American Express every time you use your card. Those fees range from about 1 to 3% of every transaction, and they cover the credit provider's overhead costs, including fraud protection, which is pretty important. They also fund the reward programs that many credit cards now offer as consumer incentives, where every dollar that you spend translates into points that can be redeemed for flights or free stuff or even cash back. Durbin, Vance, and other advocates for limiting those swipe fees argue that those are really just higher costs that are ultimately passed on to consumers. And look, they're probably right about that on some level, but this proposal, which would cap those fees and would give the Federal Reserve the power to force credit card companies to change how their reward programs are structured, well, this proposal seems likely to cause, again, some pretty serious unintended consequences that could backfire on the very consumers they're supposed to help. And this isn't a theoretical fear. We know this because it's exactly what happened after Congress imposed similar limits on debit card swipe fees as part of the Dodd-Frank law in 2010. As part of that law, fees on debit card payments were capped and they ultimately fell by about half within a few years. Ultimately, both consumers and merchants lost out. A 2013 study by economists at the University of Chicago found that merchants saved about $7 billion annually from the elimination of debit card fees, but those savings were not passed on to consumers at all. And a 2022 study from researchers at Georgetown University and Yale Law found that the collapse of debit card reward programs actually nudged consumers to use credit cards more often. And credit cards have higher swipe fees, so those higher swipe fees ultimately undercut the merchant's savings from the cap placed on debit card fees. So everybody lost here. And here's the real kicker to all of this. The mastermind behind that provision within the Dodd-Frank law, it was Dick Durbin. It's known literally as the Durbin Amendment. And he is, of course, one of the two lawmakers now leading this crusade in Congress to repeat his own mistake. If there's one thing they'll never run out of in Washington, it's unintended consequences. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more of our coverage of these issues, everything else in politics, online this week at Reason.com. And of course, head over to our YouTube page, check out the Great Moments in Unintended Consequences series, and lots of other great stuff up there as well. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
It is one of the largest and longest-running state-based conservative conferences in the nation. And a parade of high-profile national conservatives showed up for the 2024 Pennsylvania Leadership Conference. Colin Hanna from Let Freedom Ring USA has details on this American Radio Journal commentary.
There are political conferences, and then there are special political conferences. The largest conservative political conference in the country is the Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, now in its 50th year. It regularly draws more than 5,000 attendees. It is national in scope, and with very attractive admissions fees for students, it attracts a wide age range as well as a wide geographic range of attendees. Several years after the first CPAC, Fred Anton, the legendary leader of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, decided to launch a state-focused conference fashioned after CPAC, and thus the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference was born. That conference, often referred to by its initials PLC, quickly became and remains the largest state-level conservative conference in the country, and certainly one of the best. This year's PLC was especially good, with nearly 700 attendees. And I want to suggest to the faithful and patriotic listeners to American Radio Journal that you take advantage of the excellent video recordings that have been made of the conference so you can see and hear for yourselves why this conference has reached such an honored stature. Three of the more famous nationally known speakers who appeared at this year's PLC, which took place in Harrisburg last weekend, were Mary Catherine Hamm, Vivek Ramaswamy, and Dinesh D'Souza. Many of you will remember Mary Catherine from her days as a Fox News contributor, and you may wonder where she had gone. Well, that's because she went over to CNN, which the vast majority of Fox News viewers never visit. Even if you don't see much of her these days, please be assured that she is doing good work. She's whip smart and has the gift of being able to talk through an almost constant smile. She therefore defies the caricature of the angry conservative, and her arguments sound infinitely reasonable. She also has a wonderful sense of humor and appears to be genuinely happy about her life. She's worth listening to. Former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy gave a typically high-energy talk about American values and the importance of faith. Ramaswamy was raised in a Hindu household in Cincinnati, but he attended Christian schools. He is a Hindu, not a Christian, but one of the most influential Christians in politics, Bob Vanderplatz of the Iowa Family Leader, said Vivek would be more palatable in many ways for the faith-based community than Donald Trump. Ramaswamy said in his talk at PLC, "This isn't one of those ordinary elections where it's about increasing the corporate tax rate or increasing 1% here or there. This isn't one of those elections. This is where the future existence of our country is on the line." If that intrigues you, then you should listen to his speech at the PLC. And as you listen to it, put one question in the back of your minds. Was he auditioning to be Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate? Another presenter was Dr. Kevin Roberts, the new president of the Heritage Foundation. He said, "I'm here to tell you that now is the time, more than any other time in our lifetimes, to reject what the radical left wants you to be, which is to be discouraged, and instead dig ever deeper than we ever have before, because this year of 2024, is when we take this country back. I'm not necessarily suggesting that we're going to enter a season of warfare, but what I am suggesting is, at least figuratively, that the radical left has brought the culture of war to our feet, and we darn well better wake up and fight." He detailed his vision for Project 2025, which is the very broad set of policies Heritage has prepared if former President Donald Trump wins the presidency and Republicans win a majority in both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. The headliner or keynote speaker at the PLC was Dinesh D'Souza, and his speech was impassioned, a real spellbinder. If you listen to no other speaker at the PLC, be sure to play the video of D'Souza's entire speech. I should mention that the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is produced by Loman Henry of the Lincoln Institute, who of course also produces American Radio Journal. If you enjoy this program, you will most assuredly enjoy the PLC. Just go to paleadershipconference.com. and you will find the full list of conference videos. You'll be glad you did. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WASG-AM in Mobile, Alabama, WDZY-AM in Richmond, Virginia, along with KKIM-AM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.